reference made in this case, I assume, to a case we heard earlier today, State v. Church. So, our first attorney is Robert G. LaBelle, who is representing Mr. Durango.
Good morning, Chief Justice Abramson and fellow justices. I am Attorney Robert LaBelle. I represent Gabriel Durango. Mr. Durango was convicted in 1997 of two separate statutory violations. One was 948.05 and one was 948.07, specifically an exploitation.
I'm sorry. Can you make sure to speak up?
Sure. One was an exploitation case under 948.05 and one an enticement under 948.07. During the course of the trial, besides the alleged victim who testified, there was the introduction of various videotapes that were seized from the home of Mr. Durango. It's maintained by the state that what Mr. Durango did that violated the law was to make a telephone call to a young lady who was at that time 15 years old, asking her to engage in a striptease act for an amount of money. And that particular act never was consummated. In fact, there were no future phone calls and then no subsequent phone calls after the initial inquiry by Mr. Durango. During the course of trial, the state offered the videotapes that were seized from Mr. Durango's apartments. These videotapes were tapes depicting young women who were in stages of various undress who were engaged in various sexual activities. They were introduced under 904.042. At close of testimony, after the testimony was completed and before closing arguments were presented, the state offered an amendment to both counts in the information. Count 1, the 948.05, amended from a straight exploitation to an amended count of attempted exploitation. With respect to Count 2, which was the child enticement, they changed the counts as follows, or the count as follows. Initially, Mr. Durango had been charged with attempting to entice this young lady for the purpose of sexual conduct or contact. The subsections that the state sought and actually obtained by way of amendment was to include two more. One was to expose a genital, and the third was to engage in some kind of photographic experience to photograph sexually explicit conduct. Over the objection of the state, of the defense, the arguments proceeded, and the state made heavy emphasis of the videotapes, and the defendant was ultimately convicted. We are now challenging the convictions on five different grounds. One is whether the subsections under 948.07 are constituted a denial of the defendant's right to have a unanimous jury verdict, and the other is whether the two particular subsection or statutory provisions under which Mr. Durango was convicted, 948.05 and 948.07, are multiplicitous as defined by the case law. The third issue is whether the introduction of the 904 evidence was in error under the Sullivan analysis. The fourth question is whether the court correctly permitted the amendment of the information at that late date. And the fifth and last question is whether the evidence is sufficient under the Pollinger analysis. I put it a bit of a disadvantage now because I'm going to have to argue against a fellow defense attorney based on the argument that I heard earlier, but that's going to be my position. With respect to the unanimity issue, this court is presented with somewhat of a unique situation. The unanimity cases have been analyzed by the various parties in this case, are Holland and Hammer and Lamagro, and all of these basically establish a two-step process by which to determine if there has been a unanimous jury verdict to which the defendant is entitled. In this particular case, just as in the other decisions, what first has to be done is there has to be a determination of whether there's only one offense. And if there's only one offense, is it simply one offense with multiple modes of commission, or you have to determine whether it creates multiple offenses for distinct felonies which the defendant intends to commit. If there are multiple offenses, then the jury has to be unanimous. If, however, the statute sets forth Only a single crime, unanimity is required only if their separate modes of commission are conceptually distinct. It is our position that with respect to the various subsections, the three subsections in which Mr. Durango was convicted under 948.07 are necessitated a unanimous jury verdict and thereby necessitated an instruction directing the jury to agree on which subsection they were to elect.
Well, go ahead.
Counsel, do they require a unanimous or unanimity jury verdict because, number one, they are multiple offenses, or, number two, same offense with multiple modes of commission but are are conceptually distinct?
The latter.
Okay. You're agreeing that child enticement, the subsections set forth under the statute, are merely multiple modes of committing one offense. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And so you agree with your defense counsel in the prior case?
I do at this juncture. That's correct.
My recollection of your brief was that you argued that they were multiple offenses. Am I correct?
That is correct. That is precisely how I argued, and having rethought it and having heard the argument of counsel, that is our position.
You're
that it
evolving.
Is the latter. I have evolved just like the rest of the people in this courtroom. That's
a lot of evolution.
That's amazing. Yes.
Some might say spinning.
Evolving. Taking advantage of a situation. This situation specifically lends itself to the conceptually distinct analysis because if you look at the three subsections, and specifically in Durango, the three subsections that were charged were, one, exposing oneself, two, involving in an act of sexual conduct, and three, taking some kind of photographs or engaging in photographic activities. If you look to the other subsections, if you say hypothetically perhaps that Durango had been charged with giving the young lady drugs or had been involved in having her engage in an act of prostitution, clearly, in our opinion, those are conceptually distinct. You cannot have an activity in one of those subsections that equates to the other, and clearly the legislature, in its enactment of 948.07, delineated specific subsets of this particular statute.
And you're following Gibson and Alice about distinct?
Yes.
Well, the state says they're all the same, because the generalization is your intent is to entice the child. Right?
That's correct.
And therefore, they're not distinct. That's the overall umbrella. They all fit under it. And you're saying, no, they're distinct because, look at them, they're very different. The conduct is very different. But what tells us how broad we should state the generalization? How broad we should make these concepts? You make them very broad. It includes the whole statute book.
Well, I don't know that there's any specific direction other than if you take the two cases that the state used in their argument about groupings as an example. If we try and say, and I think that's what the court's talking about,
right,
is how do you group those together to determine whether they're conceptually distinct? The two cases that they rely on are Kowalski and DeQuisto.
And do they rely on Gibson?
They rely on Gibson.
Yeah. I did not bring with me, but I saw rather recently that Gibson has been challenged as making no sense because you don't know how to group.
There is no direction. I agree. There is no direction on how to group, but the two cases that they rely upon are very distinguishable because in both those cases, they're battery cases. And I think in the DeQuisto case, which is a case out of Milwaukee, where a police officer was charged amongst seven other police officers with battering a citizen, the issue was, do I get a special instruction on unanimity because you can't tell me whether my client was the person who broke Chamberlain, the victim's nose, by his fist, or when we smashed him down on the sidewalk, that's how he broke his nose. So it was all a course of conduct, and that's what they're talking about. And similarly, in the Glowoski case, which is a battery case, there's a question of was the person, did the person sustain injuries by virtue of being hit or when something was thrown at him? Again, those are conceptually very, very similar, and I think those are the type of cases where we can group. Here, the activities that are enumerated bear no resemblance to each other.
Well, you could say it's to entice a child for sexual purposes. That will cover almost everything except drugs.
That's true, except that, for instance, the exposure subsection also talks about if the defendant, the perpetrator, is the person who exposes himself. An L&L case, which is not under the same auspices of trying to protect the child from the child's engagement per se in an act of sexual conduct.
Does it have to be conceptually similar as to all of the subsections of enticement, or do you have standing only to challenge whether there is conceptual similarity or dissimilarity with regard to the subsections that the defendant is charged with?
You mean if the indictment or the if the information comes down, am I limited just to those which are contained in the information? I would think that you would be limited just to those for which the defendant that you represent was charged. That would be my position.
Well, then let's take what you're charged with. Charged with subsection 1, sexual contact, right? Subsection 3, was that the... Is that the video?
There's the photography, there's the exposure, and the contact.
Yes. Yeah. 3 is the exposure, and 4 is the taking the video. Right. Explain to me your argument with regard to those 3 subsections and whether or not they're distinct or similar.
In this particular case, especially in the evidence in Durango, it was not clear that it was the defendant's, at least from our vantage point, it was not clear that it was the defendant's intent to engage in an act of sexual conduct with the child. It is much more clear, based on the words of the child and her testimony, that what Durango had said is, I want you to engage in an act of striptease like a videotape.
Well, but there's evidence. She testified that he said that he did want her to engage in sexual contact either, and this was apparently a little vague, either with regard to himself or his friend. Isn't that in the record?
Your comment sort of to yourself is correct. It is a little vague, and in the testimony it was very unclear. And in fact, that portion of the testimony was very equivocal. She testified on one occasion that, no, there wasn't any indication of any intent or any overt or sort of sub rosa request. And then at the trial, she makes these remarks. And so if the jury is going to make that factual determination, it seems to me they have to decide whether it is that act in which the defendant is being convicted or whether it is, in fact, the photography, which in my mind is clearer. In the unanimity issue, I think the other thing is that when you look at what constitutes something as conceptually different, you take a look at the analysis that comes out of the Anderson case, and they talk about the definition, and they look at different objectives, and I think that in this particular case, the 3 subsections do in fact have different objectives. With respect to the multiplicity issue, I think, requires the Blockberger analysis. It is our position that if you take a look at the 2 elements, you use the elements test and you take a look at the 2 particular statutory provisions, clearly, without question, there is proof that is required for the proof of, or facts are required for the proof of one statute, which are not required for the proof of the other. So at first blush, the identity and law test has not been met. If, however, feeding off of the church decision, the rule of lenity does in fact apply, and if you concede, as all parties seem to have, that it is ambiguous with respect to the legislative intent on whether there should be multiple punishments, then under those circumstances, applying the rule of lenity, you literally give the benefit of the doubt to the defendant and you don't employ multiple punishments. Getting past that, you then look at the identity and fact issue. And it is our argument that when you look at the two types of conduct, that they are in fact identical in fact. It is interesting to note that in this case, the identity and fact issue is much closer than you would reasonably expect, because at the conclusion of the testimony, the prosecutor asked that count one, which is the exploitation, be changed from a completed act to an attempt. So now what you have is a person who has been convicted literally of two attempts based on the same phone call, which never resulted in completion of a completed act.
Let me ask, do you get to this argument that you're making now? You've conceded that there it's not identical in law.
Yes.
And Blockberger test says it has to be identical in law and fact.
Right.
So, and if it's not identical in law and fact,
it is our position you then, the next step, which is required to be taken irrespective of whether they're not identical in law and fact, is that you look at the legislative analysis. And then the issue, obviously, that was developed this morning is whether there is a presumption, or whether the presumption is rebuttable, or whether you simply look to see if it is ambiguous.
Do you think a presumption comes in this case?
If you look at this traditional Blockberger analysis, the presumption is utilized, and we have the responsibility of overcoming that presumption.
Is that the test you're suggesting?
I would suggest that in this particular case, rather than using the traditional Blockberger test, what we do is we say, let's look to the legislation and let's see if there is any affirmative intent to have multiple punishments employed. And if you use the latter of the two, it is our position that there is no affirmative intent.
You don't think it's clear enough to overcome the presumption? We use the standard for presumption here?
I think that I'll take the other position, that even if you use the standard test, that there is a presumption, that we can overcome the presumption, especially in light of, in this case, having the defendant charged with virtually two attempts for the same act.
Now, this is different than your first argument relating only to the internal structure of the enticement statute.
Exactly.
Right. Now, if you would take the position that Blockberger does not apply, aren't you changing a lot of our cases?
No, I still think it's consistent, because when you look at the 948.05 and 948.07 comparison, you use the Blockberger. But when you're looking,
so you're just going to follow Blockberger,
right?
Okay.
And when you use the internal analysis within 948.07, then you use the unanimity analysis that's
right.
been
okay.
established. So I think they are consistent.
How do I know when I should use which test?
Well, I don't know that I can give you a black letter law rule, but I can tell you that with respect to this case, you have very clearly defined issues, because unfortunately or unfortunately, Mr. Durango was charged with two separate counts of two separate statutes, and then there's this sub-issue within the 948.07.
Right, but in 948.07, we're only going to use one test, the intent.
Exactly.
But to determine whether it's multiplicity in 05 and 07, the 07 we're going to go to a Blockberger test.
With 05.
Okay, yes.
With 05, right. With 07, we would use just the...
Internally.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
It is our position that if you look at the four criteria from Anderson, in applying the legislative issue, you look at the language of the statute. I do not believe that the language of the statute, either 948.05 or 948.07, is anything other than ambiguous with respect to whether they intended multiple punishments. Similarly, the legislative history, I do not believe, irrespective of the Hansen decision, in which I recognize specifically states that with respect to enticement, the aggravant of the offense is the actual act of enticement, that still doesn't say anything about when you combine a 948.05 and 948.07, whether it violates the multiplicity provision. With respect to the nature of the prescribed conduct, again, you have a single act, which is a telephone call. And so if you look at it logically, and you look at it from a layman's standpoint, do you believe that the legislature intended that one phone call should give rise to 30 years worth of exposure in prison? I guess that's really the simplistic analysis. And again,
well, counsel, one phone call. Let's say in a phone call I threaten you, and I also engage in some kind of lewd language. Those are one phone call, couple chargeable offenses, right?
Technically.
Are you arguing that because there's only one phone call, you can't have?
No. What I'm arguing is in this particular case is our belief that the evidence doesn't give rise that in that particular phone call, in Durango's phone call, there would have justified any additional charges. In other words, an unlawful use of the telephone charge as well as a threat to injure. That didn't happen. And the conduct of Durango was simply, if anything, satisfied the enticement, a provision of the enticement statute. With respect to the 904 evidence, the court recently in Sullivan, and I am loathe to read back to the court its own words, but in the Sullivan case, you made it very, very clear to the circuit courts that they are to take your words seriously, that when considering the introduction of 904 evidence, they really have to apply the three-part test, and they really have to go through the weighing process, and they have to use some pretty much exquisite scrutiny in determining the applicability because the damage is theoretically so intense when that evidence is admitted. In this particular case, as an example, when you get to the third part of the test on whether the prejudicial impact is outweighed by the probative value, this court, again, says that you are supposed to take a look at engage in the balancing test, and you're supposed to really scrutinize it and come up with a conclusion. In this particular case, I will read you the words of the court. The judge basically says, and if I'm correct, the trial judge in this court, in making his determination of whether the prejudicial impact outweighed the probative value, says the following: I don't see any unfair prejudice. That's it. That's the analysis. I do not believe that's the type of close scrutiny this court was directing circuit courts to engage in when there's a simple statement to that effect. He may have in his own mind done that, but certainly the colloquy on the record between the various lawyers at the time of the trial and the judge in this case do not reflect that that type of close scrutiny was attended to. There is an addition to the fact that we believe that the evidence, the tapes specifically, do not have any purpose within one of the definitions in 904 or one of the carved out definitions in the case law. We also believe that the court erred with respect to its instruction, and I have argued that in my brief. In this particular case, the state introduced the evidence to show two purposes, at least ostensibly, motive and intent. The court determined that both motive and intent were the subsections or the sub-provisions of 904 under which that evidence was going to be admitted. When you look at the actual instruction that was provided to the jury, it was, if I can recollect, under 275, you are instructed that this particular evidence is going to be admitted for motive, intent, and I believe plan, preparation, and opportunity. So now the jury has an instruction that clearly is inconsistent with even the proper of the state and is clearly inconsistent with the adjudication by the trial court. And so they are then...
Let me interrupt you for just a minute on that.
Yes, sir.
Was the instruction given twice? Was it given at the time the videotapes were shown or beforehand, and then again at the closing instructions?
I do not know. I don't recollect. I'd be guessing.
But I know at least one of the times it was given, your argument, broader than it should have been given.
It was overbroad. There is no question about it.
And what harm do you feel occurs because of that?
Well, the purpose of the instruction is to advise this jury, especially when you're dealing with 904 evidence, that this 904 evidence is just what it purports to be, that it goes for a specific requirement that the state has to prove, or it goes for a specific purpose and that purpose only. And the cautionary instruction tells this jury, look, jury, you're not to consider for any other purpose. And now, in effect, the judge is saying, well, forget about that. You really can consider it for other purposes. I have reserved my right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. LaBelle. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Warren D. Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. I am Warren Weinstein, and I represent the state in this case. Well, I guess that we've all decided that this is a single act with multiple modes of instruction, and all we're now left with is whether the various six listed intents are conceptually distinct or not. And I agree with Mr. LaBelle that as far as he is concerned, one only need determine whether the three involved in his case are conceptually distinct, and because the fact that some other case might raise the difference that the church case, had it been instructed in that way, may have raised that issue because it was both drugs and some sexual motivation. But he didn't, and so we're left with this conceptual distinct concept, which is not very well spelled out in the case law at this point. It seems to me that what that problem is in that case, and it stems from Gibson. And if you read the Gibson case, you could easily find that the Gibson case sets forth two separate crimes. One for receiving, stealing, or storing or concealing property, and the other for bartering, selling, or disposing property. And that would be a logical result, and the court found those two groupings are conceptually distinct.
Commentators have looked at that and said you could regroup them into various other ways.
Well, yeah, you could, and it all becomes a matter of line drawing.
That's right.
And you get into some practical problems, it seems to me, when you do that. For instance, if we focus, as Mr. LaBelle did, on the underlying acts in 07, then obviously these are not the same thing. But if we focus on what is the purpose of that element in the crime, the mental state, then the mental state is the same. And what do we care if, I know it aged defendants, and that's why they care, but what, in a broader way, does it matter if he intended bad act A or bad act B? Well, under the old statute, it didn't, because it just referred to any crime against sexual morality. Just like in burglary, we say any felony. So, as long as the requisite state of mind, the bad motivation, is there, does it matter whether the motivation is one bad act versus a different bad act? That the purpose of that element, and this part I agree with Mr. LaBelle, one should focus on the purpose. And the purpose is his state of mind. And his state of mind can be more than one thing at the same time. That's one of the additional problems with the state of mind element, because in a lot of these cases, almost all of them, that come up in the context of different acts. And different acts are usually distinguishable. Even when they're continuous, one can say, well, if you say the unit of prosecution is 120 days, we can see this is three acts. State of mind, someone can entertain at the same instant all six of these states of mind. And then how do you separate them? Or more difficultly, how do you prove them? And does it really make sense to say to a jury, you have to decide which of these six he had at the time he committed the offense? Well, if he had a bad motivation, why should that matter? Seems to me it shouldn't.
Well, would you just allow a statute, a criminal statute, to say whoever intent to have a bad motivation causes or attempts to cause any child who has not attained the age of 18 to go into a vehicle secluded place is guilty of BC felony?
Well, that's not what the legislature did, because they wanted specific intent. But that is what we do with general intent. We don't specifically instruct the jury on the general intent. We assume that if the elements of the acts are there, the general intent is there. Now, it's more difficult
elements?
When it's specific.
Yeah, what are the elements here?
Here, I think that the elements are that he attempts to, or does, get a child to go into a secluded place, which are set out.
Okay.
That at the time he has the intent to do any of the prohibited
six elements,
states of mind,
six entities.
Any of the six, and that the third element is, oh, the child has to be under the age of
18,
right. And those are the elements of the enticement. And the crime is completed prior to the completion of any of those underlying acts. And if the underlying acts are in fact performed, they form a separate basis for charging a separate crime, as occurred in the Church case.
So if you had a jury of six here that they both agreed on, and one person thought committed subsection one, and the second juror thought subsection two, third juror three, beyond a reasonable doubt, that would be enough to convict.
Well, we'd have to get up to 12, but yeah.
Well, I'm giving you a six-person jury, but
oh.
We can change it.
Right.
We can have two
yes.
people for
yeah.
each of them. The
right. So long the as they all agreed that he had the requisite specific intent, i.e., any felony in a burglary, and as long as they all agreed he intended to commit a felony, that would be sufficient. In this case, we're not any felony. We're in just these six, but as long as they agreed one of the six, that's sufficient for the unanimity. Now, in my view, they're conceptually similar because they're all mental states.
That's the essence of your argument.
That's
on
right.
conception, whether it, you don't have to worry about drawing a line as to whether or not this action verb is like that action verb and how close this fact situation is, because you're saying we're just dealing with intent. We're not really, and it's irrelevant, maybe too strong a word, but it's not part of the analysis of what the underlying nature of these six elements are.
That's right. Just as in the assault case, if you hit somebody with a log or if you hit somebody with your fist, you can say on some level that is distinct, because in one you use an object, in the other you don't. But that's not what that's it's been held those are conceptually similar, or they're not conceptually distinct, because they're both the touching element of the assault statute. And the same is true of the radio and the pounding the head. Now, I think it's interesting, Mr. LaBelle pointed out, well, one of the reasons for that decision is we may not be able to prove which of the officers hit the man with the radio and which of them smacked his head into the pavement. And that's exactly the same problem you have with intent. How do you prove between several possible intents? intent is almost never susceptible to direct proof, unless you happen to have a statement.
What was he convicted of doing under 948.07?
07? Attempting to get the young lady into a building or room.
How did that...
With the records of intent, and she was under 18.
And can I push you and say, attempting to get her into a building or room, she was under 18 for the purpose of videotaping?
Well, we don't know for sure. I mean, that there is some evidence that that was one of his intents. If you, depending on how you infer some of the statements he made, he may have intended to either have sexual contact or sexual intercourse with her, and certainly he intended to
If you answered yes to my question, wouldn't you have a multiplicity problem? Because of 948.05 is the same thing?
No, I don't think so. And I think the key to the multiplicity is we have to think about the way these cases come up. First of all, there's the lesser included. And those are, there's a different element in one crime that doesn't exist in the other. Second of all, there is multiple victims. I'll use that. There are some variations of that. One act that's committed against two separate victims. And that, all of the elements are the same. So what distinguishes that is the fact that you have to prove, whatever it is, against both victims.
I guess my point is really, if the person was charged just under the videotaping, wouldn't then the exploitation really almost be a lesser included of the enticement videotaping?
The reason it's not is because that this analysis is a facial analysis of the statute, and it doesn't depend on the facts of this particular case. And since enticement can be for purposes other than videotaping, this is not a lesser included offense. The element that's different is the building.
Yeah.
But if you entice the kid into the building for purposes of smoking marijuana, and you also attempt to videotape, they're clearly different offenses. The last one is the situation that we have here where there is one act that's charged under two separate statutes, and those are the most difficult. But it's an analysis, because we're looking at legislative intent, and that's what Hunter tells us is the only thing if it's tried in a single case. It has to be what is the language of the statute, not what are the facts of this particular case. So if the legislature says the element of the crime is smoking marijuana or all of these other things, and the element of the crime over here is actual photographing, then they're not multiplicious, at least unless you can find the legislative intent to overcome the presumption. And the presumption really becomes important, it seems to me, in a multiplicity case, because there's almost never any evidence to overcome it. So the presumption ends up being the result, almost always. Not totally, but almost always. That's, I think, another reason why it's important to distinguish the unanimity legislative analysis from the Blockberger legislative analysis, because while you might do the same thing, the result is very different. In the unanimity analysis, you don't end up with any kind of presumption. Either the legislature intended it as one crime or they intended it as more than one crime. Now that answers a question in Blockberger, because after you know what the elements are, you can then apply the first test, the first step of the Blockberger test. But then, when you get to the second point, that's when you have the problem, if you don't engage in a presumption, because how do you get out of that box? If you don't have a presumption, and we can't really tell what the legislature intended here, which is almost always the case, then what's the answer in terms of whether we're going to allow one act to be charged as and convicted of two separate crimes? We could go through and ask the legislature to say each time, and in the future that might make sense, but we've got an awful lot of statutes that are already in the book.
Just apply the rule of lenity.
I don't think we'd like that.
I know.
The defense would.
Well, so when you charge under 948.07, do you have to state which one, 1 through 6, you're charging? Or just state all of them? Let the chips fall where they are.
Well, I think ethically we'd have to have evidence of all of them before we could charge
them. Well, not all of them. You need evidence.
You have to have evidence for each one you put in, some evidence for each one.
You would charge 948.07 and then select which ones.
I think the prosecutor has an ethical duty to say, if I don't have evidence that this individual intended to have this kid use drugs, then I can't plead that. But
you need evidence beyond a reasonable doubt.
No, I think you have to just be able to get to a jury on it.
Okay. And what about under 948.05?
Well, that one only deals with the videotaping or the photographing or recording in some way. So
are A, B, and C different crimes? Are they multiple crimes? Or are they, this is a single crime with multiple ways of doing it?
Now, are you talking of the exploitation?
Talking about exploitation.
The persuades, induces, and entices are probably not separate crimes. One could argue some of the things in that statute are. That we don't have any case law in this case.
I know. But what about A, B, and C? Are they three separate crimes?
Now, are you talking about...
I'm talking about 948.05.
05. Okay.
I'm just sort of testing out what you're doing in 948.07 to see if the rules apply.
Right. Well, see, the problem with 05, we got A, B, and C, but then we got subdivisions within that.
I know.
Right. So
I understand that. So I'm going to first do A, B, and C, then I'm going
to
do the subdivisions.
A, B, and C in 05 appear to me to be separate crimes, but
even though they're one subsection.
Even though they're one subsection, I think the subsections start with
Blockberger.
Well, if they are separate crimes, then there's no question that they're separate elements, and you do start with Blockberger. There's only when there's a question about whether there are separate crimes. So if you were to say, does employs, uses, persuades, and induce all under A, are those each separate crimes, then I think you'd have to do the same thing that the Court of Appeals attempted to do in Church, which is the first thing you have to do is determine whether they are separate elements or whether there are multiple modes of committing the same crime A. And then after you do that, you do have to go through Blockberger. Because that's a U.S. Supreme Court case interpreting double jeopardy, I don't think courts are free to just totally disregard it. I mean, they may be able to short circuit it some. There may be that case is an old case, and there's some case law since that might call it into question. But since it's a U.S. Supreme Court law, it seems to me you're not free to just disregard it.
Well, it just gives you a presumption, or it doesn't give you a presumption.
That's right.
It doesn't do anything else for you.
That's right.
The concept under double jeopardy is a legislative intent.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And that is particularly a state law question.
So your position, if I understand it, is 948.051B is a separate crime
From A.
Pardon me?
From A. A is right. The attempt to induce somebody to do it. B is actually doing it.
Okay, and that B is different than...
C is the other end. After you've done it, you're going to produce it and put it out on the market.
Those are three separate crimes. And if you do all three, the state can charge all three, and you can be convicted of all three. And
the jury has to be unanimous on each one of them.
On each one of them. But even internally, the jury may or may not have to be unanimous on
each one of them. If you charged both inducing and photographing and submitted that to the jury as separate crimes, the jury has to be unanimous on each one of those.
What about employs, uses, persuades, induces, entices,
or courses? That's a tougher question, and it seems to me that those, we haven't gotten into this in any great detail, but it seems to me those are multiple modes of committing that same crime.
As to 948.07, an attempt to do 948.05.1b, attempt to photograph.
Right.
Sexually explicit. You're saying is different from an attempt under 948.07.4.
You can't attempt 970.07 because the legislature has made attempt
part
of the crime. Okay. But... Yes, it's different. And one of the ways it seems to me to tell that is to say, if it wasn't an attempt but a completed act, would they be different crimes? And they are, it seems to me. One is the enticement into the building to photograph, and two is the actual photographing. Now here, it didn't get to the actual photographing because the victim went to the police.
So, but an attempt there does not equal 948.07.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. It, just like if one fired a bullet and killed person A who's standing next to person B, you might charge the death of A and reckless endangerment of B or attempted murder of B if there was some equivocation as who the person was aiming at.
But here you only had one victim.
That's right.
One act.
Right.
The example you gave me, you had one act but two victims.
You had one phone call, but it was a long phone call and there was different language in throughout the phone call.
So
there was an attempt to induce into a building and then first. And that's why it is two different crimes in this case. And it's also two different statutes. I mean, even we have those kinds of situations, and the non-support case is a good example of this, where we have really one continuous course of conduct, which we break into separate units for prosecution and say this is more than one crime, even though it's really the same thing over a number of days. That's why this particular case, because it has elements of both, it's easy to get off on one analysis when you're really talking about one of the other, on the unanimity analysis when you're really talking about the multiplicity aspect. And so this is very different from Church because in the multiplicity analysis, because we're talking about two separate statutes, where in Church the multiplicity was the same statute.
Even though I got you to say under 940.8.05 that A, B, and C are separate crimes,
but this is this statute, not 07. And that's one of the things, if I could throw in something for Ms. Crawford, that's one of the problems of the Church decision. The Court of Appeals seems to say you look at the statute and the structure of the statute and that decides it. Well, that's informative, but I don't think it's conclusive, and this is a good example of why it shouldn't be. Just because you put it into a subparagraph here, or paragraph, whatever this is, doesn't necessarily mean that it's not, that it is or it is not the same, a single crime. Under that kind of an approach, theft is multiple modes of commission, even though we all know from going to well, most of us do, I don't know about my colleague here, going to school back before the, or very soon after the trend to put all the theft statutes in place, that under the common law and under most state statutes, they were all separate crimes at one time. So the fact that the legislature now puts them in a string-on sentence really shouldn't be determinative. It's of some use in determining the overall answer to the question.
We've kept you on this issue for a while. Do you want to reach any of the other issues?
I thought that, first of all, this case was decided before, the trial court did this case before Sullivan came down and didn't have the benefit of that. To the extent that the transcript is a little loose in that regard, I think we need to keep that in mind. But the most important thing, it seems to me, especially as to the jury instruction, is what is it really that 90404 is trying to get at? It's trying to keep propensity evidence out. A lot of these cases end up focusing on that list in the statute, but in fact, 90404 evidence is admissible for everything except propensity evidence.
In fact, didn't you advance the evidence for purposes of rebuttal of the defendant's defense that was, wasn't that why it was advanced in addition to motive intent?
Well, it wasn't in a rebuttal part of the case. One could say it was to rebut arguments that he made in
the... Well, I thought I read that in your brief. Maybe not.
I don't think that it was presented in... Okay. One of the tapes may have been presented in rebuttal. I'm not sure. I don't remember that. I'm sorry.
Well, for what purpose is this, was this other conduct submitted?
Well, the videotapes, it seemed to me, show, in first of all, Mr. Durango never said in his conversation the nature of the acts that he wanted this young lady to participate in. The videotapes, although this part of the videotapes were not actually showed to the jury, the videotapes depicted certain sexual activity. So it was relevant to what he was trying to get her to do for filming. There was an inference that he wanted to film her the same way these other tapes were. Second of all, the tapes showed that the filming was in a building or a room. So it was relevant for that purpose. And third, he described the striptease as a risque striptease. The statute required, one of the statutes required that he, that the state prove he intended to have her expose a sex organ. Well, one can do a risque striptease with, according to the Supreme Court, in public with pasties and G-strings, and that would not be a violation of this statute. So that's another issue that the state had to prove. Now, it's true a lot of those were intent, but the point is, did any of those videotapes say to the jury, this guy has done this act, something in the past, therefore he committed this act? In my view, that's the part of the instruction that's the most important, not whether you list all of the possible, all of the intents or the laundry list of intents that's in the statute.
But
it's certainly better practice.
But isn't this to show that if he previously videotaped sex organ, that he's going to, that's what he was going to videotape again?
But he wasn't charged with the completed act, so you had to, that had to be inferred.
That's right, but aren't you inferring then that he has a propensity to do that, therefore this was an attempt to do it?
Well, but you don't have to reason through his character to do it, which is the problem with propensity. He's done this before, therefore he's a person with bad character. Because he's a person of bad character, he's now guilty of this crime.
I don't know where you get that second step.
That's from Professor the Marquette.
Blinka.
Yes.
Well, I don't know where he gets it from. So we're back
okay.
to that.
I haven't got an answer for that.
Well, I think you have to look at the answer in character evidence.
Right. I agree with that. So in 040, you have to reason through the person's bad character as proof that they did this crime. So long as the evidence is offered for something other than that, it's admissible, subject to 90403, of course. Everything is subject to that.
I read the Court of Appeals opinion, and it states, the state argued that the evidence illustrated Durango's motive and that it rebutted his defense that Jessica actually solicited him.
Yeah, and I don't remember whether he testified to that or that was just a statement made in the opening statements. That's what I don't remember. So,
was it offered to rebut the defense that Jessica actually solicited him? We just don't know that.
That wasn't one of the things that was mentioned in the transcript.
No, the trial court just did it on motive and intent,
right,
if I remember
correctly. General way.
But I understood that, I guess from several readings, and one immediately is this Court of Appeals opinion, that the state offered it also for purposes of rebutting the defense that Jessica had solicited him. And what was going through my mind is, if that's what it was offered for, that's in some ways an easier route than motive and intent.
Right. It is. And I think proof of the character of the secluded place is an easier route than intent also.
How are we tied? Is this court tied to the trial court's determination of motive and intent and the offered purpose being motive intent and perhaps rebutting the defense?
Pre-Sullivan, I'd say the answer was no. I guess after Sullivan, one would say that, or I would say that that's probably an open question. Sullivan seems to be going in that direction, but it doesn't actually say that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Weinstein, Mr. LaBelle, you have 5 minutes.
It's our position that at the time that the testimony was offered under 904, it was offered for the exclusive purpose to show that it was the defendant's intent to have this child go into a secluded place. There was never a mention that it was offered to rebut anything else, and I agree that now that Sullivan has come down, it places vests tremendous responsibility in the circuit courts to do this analysis. And when the court concludes, having heard all the testimony and having sat through the trial testimony, that it's going to introduce and allow introduction of evidence specifically by two exceptions as opposed to others, I think that this court should be bound by those determinations, absent some extraordinary factor on the record that was not considered by the court.
Well, what instructions were given? Do you think that the judge has to say you limit your this evidence to particular elements?
I believe that is exactly correct. That when the 275 instruction is given to the jury, that instruction is given for this express purpose of telling them you can use the evidence for exclusive, limited purposes. And I've determined that these are the limited purposes. And if in this case the judge oversteps or reaches or gives an instruction that is overbroad based on his determination, I think that minimally it confuses the jury. And secondly, it misleads them because it is an incorrect statement of a factual determination by the trial court and legal determination. I think that the testimony that was offered under 904 served no purpose other than simply to bash Mr. Durango's character. In this particular case, And when you look at the similarities, when you try to do the fingerprint type analysis that sometimes Sullivan talks about, it's interesting because the state offered that evidence to show that Mr. Durango's intent was to bring this child into a secluded place. But there's no indication that the videotapes were authored by Mr. Durango, that he participated, but more importantly, all the videotapes were of suggestive type activities. And as I argued in my brief, I think it's highly unlikely, based on everybody's personal experience, that porno flicks are going to be done in open public. So logically, they're all going to be done in secluded places, out of the view of the public. And so the fingerprint type analysis that you would reasonably expect to be conducted here was not done, and if it was done by the trial court, it certainly doesn't show that it was done incorrectly. With respect to the state's position that the 948.07 determination should be made on whether it was just intent alone, it's my position that the court should look at the Anderson holding, that when you look at what's significantly different in nature, and that's really the issue here, the operative definition is whether each requires a volitional departure of the defendant's course of conduct. And it's our position that with respect to those subsections of 948.07, it requires a different volitional act. And in order to do one, you have to do one first and then go to the other. You might be able to do them simultaneously, but it requires separate, discrete acts. And therefore, you can't simply say, let's just look to the intent, and the intent alone should be determinative. If the court has no further questions, I have.
Are no further questions. Thank you, Mr. LaBelle. Thank you, Mr. Weinstein. That concludes our hearing on 98-0642.